Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. Imagine this. During flu season, you wash your hands diligently. You take some preventive steps, such as boosting your immune system. You avoid people who are sick, yet you still develop the flu. What went wrong? Well, we may not know exactly what went wrong, but one thing is sure. The flu can strike randomly and in most people. So what do you do to best protect yourself or if the flu strikes? We will discuss this and more with our guest today. Joining us via phone from New York City is Dr. Ken Redcross. He's the author of Bond, the Four Cornerstones of a Lasting and Caring Relationship with Your Doctor, and founder of Red Cross Concierge, a personalized medical practice designed to enhance the patient-doctor relationship while providing convenient access to a full spectrum of healthcare services and holistic and wellness counseling. Dr. Redcross, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me on, Lenore. It is wonderful to catch up with you again.
It is great to have you back. It's been such a long time.
Way too long. We have to stop meeting like this.
I know, right? And you always have such good tips and advice, so it's always good to have you back on Health Chat. Listen, flu season here in the United States, it's full swing, and around the world also, people will still experience the flu, even if it's not a particular season where they live. So talk to us, first of all, about the flu. There are different types of flu, but what are we talking about in this specific case?
Yeah, you know, Lenore, you hit the nail right on the head at the top of the show you were talking about. Lots of times we do everything we can, but no matter what, each and every year, about 20% of us in the United States here can come down with the flu. And to your point, there are several different strains that actually circulate. In fact, the studies show it's really about 12 to 24 different strains in the community that we need to be really concerned about. Now, what are those symptoms that help us recognize that we're dealing with the flu? It's the same ones: fever, chills, and body aches. Body aches are very important here because that actually helps you differentiate the flu from the common cold, which tends to have a lot of upper respiratory symptoms and comes on a little bit more gradually than a flu, Lenore, which typically comes on quite abruptly.
So then you mentioned fever, body aches. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are other conditions that will present the same symptoms. So, Dr. Redcross, how do we really know that this is most likely the flu as opposed to maybe, malaria or something like that?
Sure. No, that's a very good point. And obviously, it definitely depends on where your geographical location is. That's incredibly important. Now, at least we know here in the flu and actually other parts of the world, we know that flu season tends to be between October, extending all the way out into May. Lenore, we also know that we have a peak incidence of the flu typically in December to February. Okay. So during these sort of times, you start to see a constellation of symptoms that are very significant because you're right. Malaria can come with a fever, but a fever of malaria tends to be a high spiking temp. It can also relapse and remit, coming and going. The fever that you get with the flu is a little bit different, tends to be a little bit lower. You can get up to 101, but those high spiking temperatures with malaria are quite different there.
So what are the early warning signs that you may have influenza?
Well, look, now I mentioned the fever, the body aches, and the chills. The chills are important as well, but you know what? It's different for kids, so that's even a better question because kids aren't going to tell you they have body aches, but when we see children, especially small babies who are crying and they have no tears, or you see that they're not eating as much or they're not drinking as much, and obviously you can also see kids who have flu-like symptoms with a rash as well. Kids present a little bit differently, so it's important. Definitely within that first 48 hours, that should these symptoms come down, or you come down with these symptoms, rather, you should make sure you reach out to a healthcare professional so you can come in and we can check, in fact, if you do have the flu.
So first step to take when you are an adult versus for a child, when someone comes down with the flu, the early signs, you see the early signs and you know you have the flu, what do you do when you're an adult as opposed to a child?
Well, the first thing you have to do, you have to reach out to your doctor. I tell my patients within that first 48 hours, that is when it's the most critical. So the first thing you want to do is you want to stay home. I don't want you going to work if you're feeling like you're coming down with something. Number one, you will not get better quickly, and obviously you can pass that around the workplace as well. The other thing I want you to consider is think about some things that are really different and unique. In fact, there's a homeopathic medicine. It's been used for decades. It's been shown to decrease the duration and the severity of flu-like symptoms. It's called oscillococcinum. Now, oscillococcinum, like I said, is important because there has been a study that's shown that 63% of people who took oscillococcinum within 24 hours showed a clear improvement or complete resolution of their symptoms within 2 days. So that's why I say it's important that when you start to come down with these symptoms in the first 48 hours, you want to reach out and think about some things that are a little bit more unique and don't necessarily require a prescription pad in order to get healing and health.
And oscillococcinum, is it also safe for children?
It is. That's a great question. Actually, it's safe for kids 2 years of age and older. The other thing I like about it is it doesn't make kids sleepy, or adults either for that matter, because we have a lot of things here in the United States that when kids take them, or even adults, to help them with these cold and flu symptoms, it makes them very sleepy, and that's something that luckily oscillococcinum does not do. So I'm glad you mentioned that. It's very important to highlight.
How is it available? Some people in the U.S. may have access to it, but around the world where they may not even know about it.
Yeah, the good thing is a lot of the pharmacies already know about it. So here in the U.S., as you mentioned, we have CVS and Duane Reade. But the point is, and I've traveled, and in fact, I just got back from Nice, France, a couple of months ago, and it's even there as well. So a lot of places you go, you'll find them in some of your natural food stores and in some of the grocery stores as well. Mm-hmm. They even have it available, the website, which is oscillo.com. Once again, some great health tips and a way to also access the healing through oscillococcinum as well.
So basically, today we're discussing the flu, if you're just joining us. And what we are doing is really to get some tips from Dr. Yeah. Red Cross in terms of prevention and also what to do once you come down with the flu. So it's really, really interesting tips, I must say. So Dr. Red Cross, what are the odds that the average person will come down with the flu? I mean, it's so contagious, but not everybody gets it. So what are the odds that someone will get it as opposed to the next door neighbor, for example?
You know, and it's so different, as once again, the geographical location. But, you know, most of the studies through the CDC show about 5 to 20%. And so that's why I say even when we do the best that we can, sometimes we have a smaller chance, up to a 20% chance, which is 1 in 5. And so it's important. The most important thing is to make sure that we're hand-washing, and hand-washing long enough to make sure that we don't give this flu to ourselves, whether we touch our eyes, our nose, our mouth. That's where it's kind of a portal for entry, and so that's an important thing. The other thing I should point out as well, Lenore, is that this is something that antibiotics will not help. Antibiotics are for bacteria, not viruses. So this isn't a place where an antibiotic is going to make a difference at all.
Oh, my goodness. This is such a good point you just mentioned, because for everything, a lot of people will just run to the antibiotics, especially places where you don't always need prescription to get an antibiotic.
Right.
And it's very important to understand the difference. If you could reiterate that, I would really appreciate it.
No, you're absolutely right. You know what? And I'm glad you mentioned that also, because now I lived in Puerto Rico for a bit, and I also did some work in the Dominican Republic. And those are two countries in particular, at least when I was there, Lenore, you can literally go to the pharmacy and get antibiotics. You just go in there and say you're not feeling well, and they will actually give them to you. And so we know that, once again, when you're dealing with cold and flu, the flu itself, these are viruses, and they do not respond to antibiotics. And in fact, antibiotics can cause other problems, other side effects that weren't intended in the first place. And so you don't want to make the situation worse. So you want to make sure that you follow some of the tips that we're talking today and avoid antibiotics at this point.
And speaking of this, and I just want to spend just a few more seconds on this. You talked about the ease of getting them when you were in two countries that you mentioned.
Sure.
When I go home, I used to stuck on antibiotics. Bad habit, right? I will go there, go to the pharmacy, don't have any sickness or anything. I say, okay, and I know the name of the drug that I want, the antibiotic.
Sure.
I will say, okay,
sure.
Can I get 3 boxes of this? And they give it to me, and I keep it in my medicine cabinet along with let's say like nasal spray when you have a stuffy nose.
Sure.
Just little things like that, and aspirin and things like that. So the ease of getting an antibiotic, along with aspirin, it's a bit concerned. Now that I think back, I see how crazy that was. But
well, you know, it's funny. Times have changed because you're right. That was something that we didn't think. You know, we didn't really think through that. It just seemed like, hey, if I get sick, the antibiotic fixes it, and I feel mm-hmm. better. But yeah. Now we know about antibiotic resistance. We know that there's other issues with taking antibiotics when they're not necessary. So you're right. Things have changed. We've had a lot more science around it, and I think patients are starting to hear this a lot more about the importance of trying to avoid antibiotics if at all possible.
Yes. So now let's go through let's take us through, if you may, a day-by-day strategy for addressing mm-hmm. flu symptoms effectively.
Sure. So look, the beginning, as I mentioned before, the first 48 hours are important. So I'd like to always talk to patients about the do's and the don'ts. So the don'ts that we don't want within that first 48 hours, I mentioned, I don't want you going to work, and I also don't want you sending the kids to school either, especially if you feel that they are coming down with some flu-like symptoms. You know, it's interesting because the CDC actually says that they want the kids to be fever-free for at least 24 hours off of medications, meaning like a Tylenol or something like that, before you send them back. The other don't that's very important during the first 48 hours, Lenore, is that kids that are 18 and under, you want to avoid aspirin. Aspirin and the flu with kids under the age of 18 can be associated with what's called RISE syndrome, which can be a deadly syndrome. So you want to make sure that I tell patients just avoid aspirin altogether during the cold and flu season, because I don't want anyone at risk for that. And then the other do within that first 48 hours, we touched upon it early. Make sure you get in to give your doctor a call and consider some homeopathic remedies, some things that are different, such as the acylococcinum that we mentioned, and some other things that we'll mention as we go day by day also.
Mm-hmm. And that's the first 48 hours. And we'll go further, because usually the flu will last about a week. Is that correct?
That's a good point. Usually it lasts about 5 to 7 days. So as we're in the middle of the flu, what are the don'ts there? Well, we talked about a huge one, not taking antibiotics. No role here. Now, antibiotics are only beneficial for bacteria. The number one complication of the flu is actually bacterial pneumonia. That's when antibiotics should come into play. So that's important. The thing that I do want you to do is give your doctor a call. Make sure you come in so that we can actually test you and see if you, in fact, do have influenza. Now, I promise you some other holistic things or some other things that we can use that are a little bit natural, like the acylococcinum, and one of them is black elderberry extract. I don't know if you've heard of elderberry or not, but it's been shown to, in a sense, in a way, kind of boost your immune system. In fact, it has some activity against the flu virus. It's been shown to decrease the flu severity. There's also holy basil. Holy basil is a natural expectorant that helps you thin the mucus. Once again, guys, this is not requiring a prescription here. These are things that we can get at the kind of natural food store and really make a difference. And last but not least, as another herb, it's called butterbur. Now, butterbur, it really helps as far as headaches. And the reason why I mention this is because some people during the cold and flu season, they may have these symptoms, but the thing that really bothers them when they come in the office are headaches. And so butterbur is something else that's very unique and nice to kind of bring in the middle of the flu and cold season to help you out too.
And as Dr. Red Cross mentioned, make sure you check with your medical provider sure. and to ensure that all this is you're doing the right thing and taking the right quantity and things like that, this is proper for you. So, Dr. Red Cross, we will continue the discussion. Please stick around. We have many more questions to ask. And we will be right back to learn more about some tips in dealing with the flu. Don't go away. We'll be back. But first, the news with Bon Statufa.
Thank you, Lenore. A large gathering has taken place to launch a new initiative aimed at increasing commitments for health in Africa. The gathering took place in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. The gathering included African government representatives, business leaders, and global partners. The initiative aims at closing the funding gap, improving the impact of spending, and ensuring the achievement of universal health coverage across all African Union countries. Public and private sectors, as well as donor governments, pledge up to $200 million U.S. dollars to help end epidemics and bring universal health coverage to all. Higher Life Foundation, the Government of Ireland, and the Government of France all committed to increased financing of health in Africa. The Government of Japan has also considered universal health coverage as an agenda at the G20 Osaka Summit later this year, carrying forward commitment and collaboration on health. The World Health Organization says that cases of the measles are on the rise. The WHO is urging immediate action to ensure that people be protected through vaccines. According to the WHO, provisional data shows 230,000 cases of the measles reported in 2018, exceeding the total number of cases in 2017. While global deaths from the measles have decreased by over 80% worldwide in recent years, the disease is still common in many developing countries. The WHO is calling on its partners to act with urgency, clarity, and appropriate tactics to close the gap in vaccine coverage and ensure measles vaccines are available, accessible, and delivered to all children who need them. Finally, a joint study finds the vast majority of the world's children lack effective social protection coverage. That joint study was performed by the International Labor Organization and UNICEF. The study says that this dooms children to a life of extreme poverty with negative implications for society. The study finds only one-third of children 14 and younger have any social protection. That means over 1 billion children live without a social safety net. The report finds children fare best in Europe and Central Asia, where over 80% have social protection coverage, followed by children in the Americas. The report highlights the impact extreme poverty has upon the lives of children and the societies in which they live in. The ILO and UNICEF recommend the rapid expansion of social protection for children, including the consideration of universal cash grants to children. And that's a wrap-up of your latest health news.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Hello, this is James Butty, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late tonight, we are discussing the flu and getting some tips on what to do to prevent or to manage the flu. Joining us via phone from New York is Dr. Ken Redcross. He is internal medicine specialist and concierge doctor, and he is also author of the book Bound, the Four Cornerstones of a Lasting and Caring Relationship with Your Doctor. Dr. Redcross, I wanted to ask you about the book before we go back to the flu.
The title
is very interesting, but you talk about bonding with the doctor, with your doctor. Why is it so important to bond with your doctor?
You know, it's so important. One of the things you always hear me say, actually, Nord, is that a doctor should feel like a member of your family. I believe that that improves healthcare outcomes, especially when you feel like you can reach out to your doctor, give a quick call, and say, you know, is this something I need to come in for and be evaluated and assessed? It's even more important, really, as we talk about the flu, because we know that the flu can go a negative direction quickly, and you want to make sure that you have a good relationship with your physician in order to make sure you do get the benefit of some beautiful healthcare outcomes.
So are there instances where you don't necessarily need to see your doctor even when you are managing the flu?
You know, I'll tell you this. This is one of those things that because the flu can change so quickly, I think it's still important to kind of reach out. Should your symptoms not change, that magic number again, 48 hours comes up. Because should things not change within that particular time frame, it's important to get in because the flu, especially on two particular groups of people, small children and our older patients, when it really can wreak havoc on them and really change quickly. So that's why I still think it is incredibly important to have a good relationship with your physician so that you can pick up the phone and we can kind of help you tease through some of your symptoms of whether you need to be seen at the moment or not.
I'm asking because a lot of people like to do self-medication, and I used to be a culprit, you know, when I talked about stacking up my medicine cabinet. A lot of time it would just stay on the shelf. I don't really need it. But then when I would have something minor, what I think was minor, I'll just take a pill and think, that's it. I don't need to see the doctor. But you are advising everyone to have that relationship with the doctor and always check with him. Or her.
Exactly. Very, very important at that point, especially if you get to that magic window where, you know, I feel like I'm not really getting better. I feel like things are getting a little worse. So more importantly, Lenore, if it is actually affecting your activities of daily living, you have patients who are maybe in their 40s or 50s, and all of a sudden they recognize they can't breathe as well as they could the last week before with these symptoms. That could be a sign of pneumonia. That can be a sign for some older patients of congestive heart failure. So that's why I say, if you have that relationship and those four things that are important with your doctor, which I say are trust, respect, empathy, and communication, if all four of those are working together, then you should feel really well protected as far as your health.
You know, it's funny because I was going to ask you, you almost answered my question, but I would like to get your take on this. When you talk about bonding with the doctor, before bonding with the doctor, you have to choose a doctor. What kind of advice would you give the average patient in terms of making sure that you choose a doctor that you are comfortable with? Because I know in my case, I was going to see a dermatologist, and as soon as the doctor walked in the room, we just interacted for 2 minutes, and I just decided to leave. She was going to talk more about whatever it was that I wanted to take care of, but I didn't feel comfortable about keeping her as a doctor. So what are some tips that you can give us in terms of choosing a doctor?
Well, you know, that's probably the most important thing before you start the bond that I love talking about. Now, the first one you kind of hit on is your gut feeling. What does your gut tell you? When you get in there and you actually meet that particular physician or provider, are they even looking at you in eye to eye? Do you feel like there's a mutual respect? The other thing is word of mouth is probably the most powerful tools that we can utilize. What is everyone in your community saying about Dr. X? Are they saying, hey, Dr. X gets me in, he's great, he or she, they're funny, they make me feel good? Those are the things you want to do. The other thing you can do, and this is a little bit more challenging, but if you get online, sometimes you can go on some of those websites that rate us or rate the doctor. Those are kind of tough at times because sometimes you do get a good indication. But look, doctors, it's like everyone else. We're all human, and so sometimes it may be a day that we're not ourselves
either.
Have a bad day. So I usually say go through them and try to pick out some of the better ones, but see if there's some things in the relationship that you like to hear that's actually been mentioned in some of the reviews.
That's very important. Thanks for that tip. I hope next time I don't have to walk out after 2 minutes. So listen, talking about the flu, coming back to the flu, I know you gave us some tips up until the middle of the week. Let's continue even toward the end. And what do you do up until the end? Because there are times as well where sometimes you think you're feeling better. You even stop the medication in the middle of the treatment. You go back to work and you maybe even still contagious. So please walk us through until the end of the week.
I will. The first thing I'll say before we talk about the end of the week, please don't stop your medicine, guys. Keep it going throughout. That's the big key. But you're right. So on the downside of this, let's talk about the don'ts. One thing I don't want you to do is, you know, it's interesting. Here in the United States, especially down south, there's always a joke about hot toddies. Hot toddies are tea, and maybe you put a cap full of bourbon or alcohol or something there to kind of open up your nasal passages. And while it can help you with sleep, the problem is the alcohol can actually dehydrate frustrate you, and that's what we don't want. I also tell patients, especially if you're feeling a little, for lack of a better medical term, oozy, when you're lying flat, it's hard to keep from coughing. I like patients to kind of prop up their pillows so that the secretion is drained downward and doesn't hopefully keep them up at night. But the things I want you to definitely do is you have to get rest and you need to relax. Rest is incredibly important. The CDC says we need 7 hours of rest, and that's because rest is very important for our immune system. The other thing is we want to stay extremely hydrated. Now, I like water. I like coconut water as well, which is another way to get potassium and the hydration. But there's also bone-based broth, I should say. Try saying that quickly. That's important to make sure that we're getting hydrated properly, along with hot tea and honey. So these are all things, really, Lenore, that are focused on hydrating you and getting you back to your feet. Because lots of times during the cold and flu season, we feel crummy because we're dehydrated, and that's what we need to avoid.
So lots of water, that's important, and coconut water is good, right, as you mentioned. So then, let's see, so we are not stopping the medication, we keep going with it, and then we get toward the end of the week. What do we do? What are the don'ts and the do's?
Exactly. And now we have those. Now, the thing that's so important is just to recognize, and I already hit upon it, but sleep is incredibly important because literally it only takes one sleepless night to kind of start coming down with the symptoms where your body doesn't feel right. How many times have you missed the night of sleep and you wake up the next day, your nose is runny, you feel beat up, you feel like you're coming down with something, even though you're not? It's just the fact that your body hasn't had a chance to really kind of repair itself and rejuvenate with sleep, which is the whole purpose that the good Lord created, that we all have to sleep in order to function and survive.
Yes, a good night's sleep. And what about one or two tips to get? I know 8 hours of sleep is what is recommended, but it's just not possible for some people. I'm one of those people. I don't remember the last time I slept 8 hours. So what can we do to get a good night's sleep?
Well, one of the things that's important, it's also good for our cardiac health, is exercise. Now, whatever exercise it is for you is okay. It doesn't have to be intense training. I'm an intense athlete trainer. Not everybody that works for everyone. Some people love Tai Chi. I'm also someone who enjoys meditation. So any of these things that help with relaxation and get your body moving is what I suggest. It gives you a lot of those good endorphins that make you feel good in the first place, but also allows you to relax, especially towards the nighttime as well. So let's make sure we're putting fitness in here as well to really help a lot with our sleep. The other thing is we want to avoid things such as cigarettes, caffeine. Those things obviously keep us up at night and disrupt our REM sleep. So those are some things that are some modifiable behaviors that we can control to make sure we get a better night's sleep.
And Dr. Red Cross, do you have any suggestions in terms of the best time to exercise? Will it be in the morning or at night? Because that's something I'm always a bit confused with.
Yeah, you know, and that's a personal preference. I myself prefer, you know, 8, 6 a.m., 7 a.m. workout because I kind of feel great throughout my day.
Okay.
But then when I can't do that, I kind of like it at bedtime or closer to the evening, I should say, because then I've had a really strenuous workout and then I feel really good, take a shower, and I'm ready to go to sleep. So it really depends on the person and really your lifestyle for what works for you. The important thing is just to get your body moving, because when it's time to rest, all that exercise you did in during the day can make a huge difference. The other thing I'll let everyone know, please don't say you don't have enough time, because a lot of the studies show that 15 minutes, just 15 minutes a day, can make a huge difference. You just want to make sure that that's high-intensity interval training. But it's something that can definitely make a sleep, a difference, I should say, to help you with your sleep. So just 15 minutes a day can make a huge, ginormous difference.
Dr. Red Cross, it was so good to have you back on Health Chat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Lenore. Have a blessed day, everyone.
Thank you. And that was Dr. Ken Red Cross, internal medicine specialist and concierge doctor. We thank him for joining us today from New York. For more on today's topic, log on to our website at voanews.com. You can also join us on facebook.com/VOA Health Chat, and let's keep the conversation going. Just look for Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou in Washington, with producer Bonsa Tufa and engineer Cornelius. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News. I'm Faith Lapidus.